headlines. Yemenis rally in the northern city of Sanaa to condemn the UN for turning a blind eye to the massacre of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia. A Ukrainian soldier is killed in the conflict torn east of the country in a mortar and grenade attack by pro-Russia forces. And India reports more than 1,100 corona-related deaths and nearly 49,000 new infections in one day. Hello and welcome to the World News. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to Yemen this hour, where the people of Yemen have staged a demonstration in the province of Sanaa to condemn the United Nations for its inaction, the violation of their rights, including those of children. Protesters also expressed their anger towards the recent UN decision to include Yemen's Ansar Allah movement on its black list of parties violating children's rights. The resistance movement itself had earlier denounced the measure by calling it disgraceful, unjust, and far from reality. It accused the world body of turning a blind eye to the massacre of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia over the past years. Since Riyadh launched its devastating military campaign against Yemen in 2015, thousands of children have been killed or displaced. Yemeni officials say more than 2.6 million Yemeni children also suffer from malnutrition, and hundreds of them are in urgent need of medical treatment abroad. A senior official from the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the U.S. seizure of pro-resistance news website domains is aimed at preventing people in Western countries from being informed about the reality of Israeli crimes against Palestinians.
They are going to prevent their own people to know, to understand what is the real attitude of Israel against our people. The loser will be the American one. The loser will be the Western people, the European people. But this will not prevent the information to be in the hands of all the Islamic world and the Arab world.
Al-Zahar said Washington's recent move is even against its own policies. Well, the Hamas official also noted that there is no difference between U.S. Democrats and Republicans when it comes to supporting Israel's atrocities. On Tuesday, the U.S. confiscated the domains of 36 Iranian and regional media websites, including that of Press TV. Viewers trying to access these websites see a message showing the domains are seized by the U.S. government. Well, the move has sparked criticism from activists. Well, Iran is marking American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion seeks to shed light on the U.S.'s rights violations based on a series of crimes that Washington has committed against Iran in the 1980s. Yusuf Janali brings us more.
The month of Tir on the Iranian calendar marks a series of tragic events that occurred during the early years of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. From the U.S. Army's shooting down of an Iranian airliner in 1988 to the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen Khalq terror group are examples of the incidents that fall in the same time frame, between late June and early July.
The U.S. footprints can be traced in almost all of the incidents that occurred during this period. The events were so harsh and fateful that are still remembered by Iranians after decades. Every year, Iran marks June the 26th to July the 2nd as the Week of American Human Rights. As a jab, that questions the U.S. standing as rights advocate.
The week-long occasion is associated with nationwide ceremonies. Each day commemorates one of the incidents. The first day marks the attempted assassination of the then-president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981. The second day marks the bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran in the same year. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti. The event is known in Iran as the 7th of Tir disaster. This incident was also carried out by the MKO terror group. In 2012, the United States removed the MKO from the list of terrorist organizations something which is interpreted as Washington's dual take on terrorism.
The United States' hostility toward Iran became more evident after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. It supported Iraq's Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran, and also funded and supported the MKO terrorists in numerous attacks on Iranian people. So we review these incidents during this week to let the world know that the U.S. is not a defender of human rights.
The week also marks Iraq's 1987 chemical attack on the city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province. During the 8th year, Iraqi imposed war on Iran. At least 110 people were killed, and 5,000 more were injured in the attack, which was carried out using chemical weapons provided by the U.S. and some other Western countries.
The chemical bombardment of Sardasht was one of the most heinous crimes against humanity. Sardasht was the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki to become the target of weapons of mass destruction. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed a huge arsenal of chemical weapons, which were produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Observers say Washington portrays itself as the defender of human rights across the globe, but it uses the issue as an excuse to exert pressure on other countries, while closing its eyes on its own rights violations. Organizers hope the week-long ceremonies will help shine a light on the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Ukrainian military says one of its soldiers has been killed in shelling by pro-Russian forces in the eastern Donbas region. Ukraine's army accuses fighters of firing on its troops with mortars and anti-tank weapons from near their administrative center of Donetsk. It says it has returned fire. Now, fighting has continued since 2014 in Ukraine's volatile Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which are collectively called Donbas. Numerous ceasefires have been agreed upon between Kiev and pro-Moscow troops, only to fail. Well, the belligerent sides accuse each other of violating those agreements. Thousands of people have lost their lives in the long-running conflict. Well, the new coronavirus variant, known as Delta, is spreading to more countries throughout the globe. In South Africa, the new variant appears to have started dominating COVID-19 infections. Now, the country reported more than 18,000 new cases on Friday. South Africa is in the middle of its third wave of the pandemic. Officials say it is now likely that the peak of the third wave would surpass the peak of the second wave in January. The new variant has also hit Portugal hard, where over 70% of the cases in the Lisbon area are due to the Delta variant. Well, the new variant is also spreading fast in Australia, forcing authorities in Sydney to implement a two-week lockdown. The Delta variant, which was first identified in India, is more contagious and more deadly. Meanwhile, India has reported over 48,000 new COVID-19 infections, bringing the country's total caseload to nearly 30.2 million. The Indian Health Ministry also logged over 1,100 more deaths in 24 hours. This has pushed the country's total COVID fatalities to nearly 400,000. Just under 4% of the population in India has been vaccinated in the nationwide vaccination program. Now, the daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Health officials have urged people to remain vigilant, warning that a third wave is inevitable. Our New Delhi-based correspondent, Monawar Zaman, says coronavirus infections in India are dropping, but the southern parts of the country are still reeling from the second wave.
There is a dramatic change. The cases are going down. The infection is slowing, but the southern parts of the country are still reeling. For example, Karnataka, that's the southern part of the country, from where we see the maximum number of cases coming on daily basis. From rest of the parts of the country, especially if we talk about metropolis or the big cities or the mega cities, the cases have come down significantly and there is less burden on the healthcare facilities now. But rural parts of the country are still dealing with the infection because the healthcare there is non-existent. People are still struggling to cope with the second wave. And the important update that we have is just a few minutes ago, 15 to 20 minutes ago, the country's Prime Minister Modi, held a meeting with the top officials in health ministry and, of course, the expert from the scientific bodies as well. And and he updated the country about the COVID vaccines, and he asked the health officials to make sure that everybody is vaccinated, and we reach every part of the country with our vaccination drive.
Well, the World Health Organization has criticized the shortage of coronavirus vaccines in poor countries, calling it a global failure.
The world, as international community, other world is failing. As global community, we are failing. The problem is vaccine supply. And even now, it's not the absorptive or the delivery problem that's a problem. There is no vaccine.
The WHO chief said the vaccination situation in many low-income countries, especially in Africa, is worrisome. He said while less than 2% of the population is vaccinated in these countries, the infections are surging by 50% on a weekly basis. He also raised concern about the Delta variant that first emerged in India and its rapid spread among unvaccinated populations. Ghebreyesus said the only way to prevent the emergence of new variants is to thwart further transmission of the virus. He warned that otherwise new variants will continue to emerge. Meanwhile, Australia's largest city is set to enter a two-week lockdown amid the outbreak of a highly infectious variant of COVID-19. Now, the curbs will affect Sydney, the state capital of New South Wales, and some surrounding areas as of Saturday. Under the new rules, people can leave home for essential work, medical care, education, or shopping. Public gatherings will be banned in the rest of the state, and masks will be obligatory indoors. The state premier says restrictions will be eased if cases decrease in 7 days.
If we're going to do this, we need to do it properly. There's no point doing a three-day lockdown and then having the virus continue to bubble away in the community. Now, if after 7 days there's a dramatic change in the trend, well, obviously we will evaluate the situation. But at this stage, the best health advice we have is that a two-week period, or until midnight the Friday the 9th of July, is necessary in order to make sure we get to our target of zero community transmission, which has always been our target from the beginning of the pandemic.
Australia has so far reported more than 30,000 cases and just over 900 deaths since the start of the pandemic. But the fast-spreading outbreak of the Delta variant of the virus in Sydney has raised concerns. Meanwhile, Iran has registered 123 new COVID-19 fatalities in 24 hours, raising the overall death toll to more than 83,700. The health ministry also confirmed over 7,000 new infections during the past day. The country's total caseload now stands at over 3.1 million. Iran has been witnessing a downward trend in cases and deaths since April, when the government imposed strict nationwide restrictions. Health officials in some provinces are warning about a resurgence of the disease due to the new strands. Iran's vaccination drive is progressing slowly, but efforts are underway to speed it up using imported vaccines, as well as Coviran Barakat. Iran would need 160 million doses to inoculate the whole population. So far, only around 5.6 million vaccines have been administered. Well, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, who was awaiting an Iran-made vaccine, has finally received a Coviran Barakat jab. Hashtag trending brings you people's reactions to this story on social media.
Hello everyone, it's Sarah here with another hashtag trending. Whether you like it or not, the COVID-19 pandemic is still among the top stories across the world and keeps trending online as well. So in today's edition, we will be looking at social media's reactions to the recent rollout of the Iranian-made coronavirus vaccine. Stay tuned. It's called Coviran Barakat and has been approved for an emergency mass application. Iran's vaccination drive has been moving at a slow pace, mainly because of U.S. sanctions interfering with its attempts to obtain foreign vaccines. But these homegrown vaccines can significantly lighten the road for the health sector and speed up the process. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, also received his first jab of the Iranian-made vaccine on Friday. The leader said he had been determined to wait for the homegrown vaccine, Here's a tweet from his official page. I told the dear developers that thank God you have been prompt and dedicated in developing a suitable COVID vaccine. You should publish the relevant scientific papers and documents for the world's information. This is very important and must be done. Hashtag proudly Iranian. For your information, Iran now is the sixth country in the world to accomplish this feat. The next comment from Ali Naghavi, he said in response to the leader's tweet, see the difference? A big sigh of relief for Big Pharma and more angst and anxiety for developing nations with rising COVID infections. Bill Gates says no to sharing vaccine formulas with the global poor to end pandemic. That's a very interesting observation. In another tweet, Abu Bakr quoted from Dr. Marandi, Imam Khamenei had set two conditions for receiving COVID vaccine. Condition number one, he will not be vaccinated out of turn. Condition number two, he will only receive an Iranian vaccine. Since vaccinating everyone over 80 in the country has finished, he will receive the vaccine in the next few days. This is obviously from before the leader received his first dose, but anyway, that's nice to know. And another tweet from the Iran embassy in the UK, they say, Head of Food and Drug Administration of Iran, the World Health Organization has granted permission to Iran's Food and Drug Administration to approve the vaccine. If Iran approves a vaccine, it means that the World Health Organization has licensed it, even in other countries besides Iran. It's interesting to know that, quote, Iran Barakat is not the only Iranian-made vaccine in production. There are at least three more vaccines ready to hit the market in the coming weeks and months. And that's it for today's edition of Hashtag Trending. Hope you liked it. And until next time, stay safe and bye-bye.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who murdered George Floyd, has been sentenced to 22 years and 6 months for second-degree murder, closing one chapter of a case that thrust the issue of race and American policing back into the global spotlight. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Oliver Loughlin. The piece is titled, Derek Chauvin Sentenced to 22.5 Years in Prison for Murder of George Floyd. Derek Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who murdered George Floyd, has been sentenced to 22 years and 6 months for second-degree murder, closing one chapter of a case that thrust the issue of race in American policing back into the global spotlight. The 45-year-old appeared in court on Friday, 25th of June, dressed in a gray suit and with a shaved head, 2 months after a jury found him guilty on 3 charges relating to George Floyd's death. The sentence issued by the Hennepin County Judge, Peter Cahill, was a 10-year increase to the state's recommended sentencing guidance for second-degree murder. Prosecutors successfully argued that Derek Chauvin should face harsher sentencing due to a range of aggravating factors. Judge Peter Cahill offered only brief remarks before delivering the sentence, saying his decision was not based on emotional sympathy, but adding, "I want to acknowledge the deep and tremendous pain that all the families are feeling, especially the Floyd family." Judge Peter Cahill explained his reasoning for the harsher sentence in a 22-page sentencing memorandum released by the court, writing, "Part of the mission of the Minneapolis Police Department is to give citizens voice and respect. Here, Mr. Chauvin, rather than pursuing the Minneapolis Police Department mission, treated Mr. Floyd without respect and denied him the dignity owed to all human beings, and which he certainly would have extended to a friend or neighbor." The announcement followed victim impact statements from members of the Floyd family, including his 7-year-old daughter, Gianna. In a recorded video message, she was asked what she would say to her father today. Gianna said, "It would be, I miss you and I love him," she said. Prosecutors sought a maximum sentence of 30 years, a plea reiterated by members of the Floyd family as they delivered statements in person. "Every day I have begged for justice to be served. Reliving the execution of George, while others begged, they pleaded for Officer Chauvin to simply just allow George to take a breath," Floyd's brother, Philanese Floyd, told the court. "I haven't had a real night's sleep because of the nightmares I constantly have hearing my brother beg and plead for his life over and over again." Terrence Floyd, another of George Floyd's brothers, directly addressed the former police officer who sat before him showing little visible emotion. "I wanted to know from the man himself why. What were you thinking? What was going through your head when you had your knee on my brother's neck? When you knew that he posed no threat anymore, he was handcuffed. Why you didn't at least get up? Why you stayed there?" Keith Ellison, the Minnesota Attorney General whose office brought the case to trial, described the sentence as one of the longest a former police officer has ever received for an unlawful use of deadly force. He called it another moment of real accountability on the road to justice. "My hope for Derek Chauvin is that he uses his long sentence to reflect on his choices and his life," Keith Ellison said. "My hope is that he will be able to find it within himself to acknowledge the impact of his choices on George Floyd, on his family, his fellow police officers, and the world." The famed civil rights attorney, Benjamin Crump, who represents the George Floyd family and other victims of police violence, described the punishment as a historic sentence that brings the Floyd family and our nation one step closer to healing by delivering closure and accountability. George Floyd's sister, Bridget Floyd, said in a statement, "The sentence handed down today to the Minneapolis police officer who killed my brother George Floyd shows that matters of police brutality are finally being taken seriously, However, we have a long way to go and many changes to make before black and brown people finally feel they are being treated fairly and humanely by law enforcement in this country. Under Minnesota good behavior law, Derek Chauvin could serve only two-thirds of the sentence in prison, with the rest under license released. Earlier on Friday, Judge Peter Cahill rejected a motion by defense attorneys for a new trial. Derek Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, requested the court issue a probatory sentence only. Derek Chauvin spoke briefly to the court, suggesting that additional legal matters prevented him from speaking at length. Very briefly, though, I want to give my condolences to the Floyd family. There's going to be some other information in the future that would be of interest, and I hope some things would give you some peace of mind, he said. Derek Chauvin's mother, Carolyn Polenti, asked the court to show restraint and said, despite the unanimous guilty verdicts on second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter, that her son was innocent. She did not address the Floyd family. My son's identity has also been reduced to that of a racist, she said. I want this court to know that none of these things are true and that my son is a good man. She added, the public will never know the loving and caring man he is, but his family does. Even though I have not spoken publicly, I have always supported him 100% and always will. George Floyd's death on 25th of May 2020 ignited racial justice protests around the United States and the wider world. Derek Chauvin's trial was seen as a litmus test for police accountability in the United States.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Africa Today.
Despite an estimated 2,000 languages being spoken across Africa, for many to succeed in the continent, they have no option but to learn English or French, the languages of the countries which colonize most of Africa. Now, experts are warning that this trend might lead to the extinction of indigenous languages. Renowned African writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o says abandoning one's indigenous language is tantamount to enslavement. Let's take a listen.
There's a difference between adding another language to what you already have, which I call empowerment, and what I call, and the other, where you add many languages you remove your own language completely, and then you acquire other languages, which they call enslavement. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the dangers that African languages are facing amid rapid globalization, which has seen the dominance of English and French. Our experts will provide an incisive analysis and present possible solutions to this challenge facing African nations, which are fighting to preserve their identity. It will be great hearing from you, so keep in touch through our social media handle.
English, French imperil African languages. Africa has 55 countries that use a variety of languages, including some that are endangered due to several factors, especially the influence of Western culture. Every African language is a repository of history, culture, and values. So when a language dies, so too does history, culture, values, and the sense of identity. African language experts are waking up to the reality that a lack of school reading material in local languages is increasingly sounding the death knell for mother tongues.
With bilingual education, children are more active because they master the language. They are not afraid to speak to the teacher. They communicate better in a local language, a language they know well.
Experts and activists across Africa are now trying to restore the link between the people and their mother tongues. Now, for more analysis on this subject, we contacted Professor Kimani Njogu. He's a Kenyan linguist and a publisher who is also a member of the Kiswahili Cross-Border Language Commission at the African Academy of Languages, an organ of the African Union. Thank you very much, Professor.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
We also have Mr. Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist based in Kampala, Uganda. Thank you also for joining us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, first tell us, why is it important to maintain indigenous languages in Africa?
Well, you see, languages are carriers of culture. They are also carriers of knowledge, and they are carriers of histories. And this is not particular to African languages or indigenous languages. This refers to virtually all languages of the world. Therefore, when we preserve and develop indigenous African languages, we are, in a sense, appreciating and recognizing their place as carriers of African history or the histories of the African people and their experiences, as well as their knowledge systems and their philosophies and their values and so forth and so on. So the development and the promotion of African languages is part of a whole system of appreciating knowledge production from the African continent.
Thank you for that, Professor Kimani Njogu.
Love for European languages in Africa comes from the colonial mentality that foreign languages are better than their local languages and are a guarantee for the future. Once young people go to higher education, they abandon their mother tongues, thinking they are archaic, and prefer to speak foreign languages such as French or English.
Now, Mr. Kiiza, how has over-reliance on European languages while abandoning local languages affected development in Africa?
We have lost on this freedom of determining our own development path as Africa because the current narrative and agenda of development is informed by the culture and language of the West. So it is important if we are to develop as Africa from our own pace, and often as Africa we have been saying we wish to have Africa solutions to African problems. We cannot have this narrative. We cannot achieve this narrative of having African solutions to African problems when we keep relying on a language which is not ours.
Now, globalization and social media are also driving Africans away from their mother tongues. Many people are also no longer feeling proud to speak their mother tongue, as English and French and other European languages have replaced local languages in homes and schools in many parts of Africa. Our Zimbabwean language expert here speaks on the importance of the preservation of indigenous languages. Let's listen.
it's good to share information, exchange ideas, but at the end of the day, who are we? We need to know our identity. We need to actually build on what we know, build on what makes us, you know, Zimbabweans.
Professor Akimani Njogu, now how serious is the threat faced by African languages from European languages, especially English and French?
They are in danger, really, of this suppression and domination by European languages, notwithstanding the fact that they are the ones, that is African languages, they are the ones that are spoken by over 70% or 80% of Africans across the continent. Therefore, the danger here is that the continued domination of indigenous languages or African languages by European languages undermines African histories, African philosophies, and the contribution of the continent to knowledge, global knowledge. And therefore, it's really a very serious issue here.
It's quite clear that European colonial languages have continued to dominate in education, commerce, the media, and interaction between African countries. While international languages are crucial for communication and academic transfer and engagement, the use of indigenous languages ensures that local populations are integrated in the development agenda. Is the use of English and French in most development documents in Africa discriminatory to those who do not understand or actually do not want to use these languages?
African countries are actually, currently we are negotiating the African Continental Free Trade Area, an agreement that is going to unite to bring about an open market, a common market of free movement of goods and services within Africa. But there is actually fighting amongst the Francophone-speaking Africa, the French-speaking Africa, and the English-speaking Africa countries because of the fact that which language takes precedence.
Local languages in Africa, just like in many parts of the world, are the basis for cultural identity and local development. African languages that survived the colonial era are now facing the danger of extinction amid an onslaught by European languages. During a visit to Burkina Faso in 2018, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled his strategy to promote his native language, aiming to make it the first language in Africa.
Now let's go back to Professor Akimani Njogu. Do you think the gradual disregard of indigenous languages in Africa is a deliberate move by imperial powers to wipe out the identity of African people?
Well, let me say this, that the colonial project was always a project of domination and suppression of competing ideas. And therefore, under colonialism, the French deliberately suppressed African languages in their colonies, and the British did the same with regard to African languages. And the Portuguese did the same. Therefore, one could say that the colonial project was a project to deny the African people their identity and the base from which they could recollect their history. And even in situations where these languages were supported, they were not deliberately developed. And this has continued through the post-colonial period.
Now, speaking in 2019 during the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed spoke on the need to preserve, revitalize, and promote indigenous languages.
Almost half the world's estimated 6,700 languages are in danger of disappearing. Many of those belong to indigenous people. With every language that disappears, a world loses a wealth of traditional knowledge and cultural heritage. Education will have a pivotal role to play in ensuring that indigenous people can enjoy and preserve their culture and identity. Intercultural and multilingual education will be necessary to prevent the irreparable loss.
Now, Mr. Kiza, what are some of the urgent measures that need to be taken to ensure that future generations in Africa continue using local languages?
Yes, that's an interesting question. The first one and most critical is human capacity, human capital development. We need to invest in building the capacity of our human resource, of our development policymakers, of our negotiators, especially the young ones, of the development commentators, in ensuring that they speak our own languages, in investing resources in our own universities of higher learning, our own research institutions, to teach in African languages, to teach development from an African perspective and reality is another issue which I think is critical if African countries are to nurture and to bring back the African languages with among the young generations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Africa Kiza, for your insight today. Now we shall take a short break, so don't go away.
English, French imperil African languages.
In 2019, linguistic history was made after students at the University of Cape Town in South Africa graduated from an indigenous language course with roots that date back more than 200,000 years. The Khoisan are known to be one of the earliest inhabitants of Southern Africa, but their language was largely lost during the colonial period. A student who studied the language in university speaks on her accomplishment.
The course itself was an amazing journey to go on to learn this language that was used by my ancestors, by everyone's ancestors. Definitely made a change in my life, and it makes a change in everyone's life, just even to know a few words out of it.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, what sort of intervention is needed to uplift the indigenous languages in Africa?
Now, I think the first place for immediate intervention is to look at the educational system and to ask the question, how can we build a continuity, a continuum between what the child experiences within the community in terms of language and what the child experiences within the educational system? How can we build a continuity in the two experiences?
Renowned African novelist from Kenya, Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o, didn't deliver his acceptance speech in English when last year he was honored as the 31st recipient of the Catalonia International Prize, for his daring and distinguished literary work and defense of African languages. He has been writing in his native Kikuyu language since the 80s after abandoning English. Ngugi wrote a book titled Decolonizing the Mind, The Politics of Language in African Literature. He explains here on how he made the revolutionary decision to write in his mother tongue.
That I would no longer write my fiction or poetry in English anymore. I was going to write in an African language, and I was going to write in the only language then I knew quite well, which was Kikuyu. I had to do this. I had to find a way of connecting myself to myself, you know, and I had to go against that whole colonial assumption, you know, that people can only know themselves via England, in this case, or via European languages, or via Europe.
In July 2004, Kiswahili was declared the official language of the 55-member African Union, with the then-chairperson Joaquim Chissano delivering his entire speech during the AU summit in the language. Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, you earlier talked there about the Swahili or Kiswahili language. As we know, the African Union has adopted Swahili language as one of its official languages. Do you think this language can be used as the lingua franca in Africa?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, first of all, we must commend the African Union for taking the position that Swahili or Kiswahili be adopted as one of its official languages and therefore used at the African Union meetings, at the Pan-African Parliament, and other, you know, fora across the continent. That action is very significant because it makes Kiswahili the only African language that plays that role at the African Union level. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that there is immense hope in the utility of Kiswahili as the lingua franca of the continent, or even just and without in fact suggesting that Kiswahili will undermine, you know, other languages. It will sit alongside other African languages, but it will play a very important role in encouraging inter-ethnic communication and international communication across the continent.
Thank you very much, Professor Kimani Njogu, for that insight.
Last year in South Africa, Swahili was approved as an optional language for the country's schools. South Africa was the first Southern African country to offer Swahili as an optional subject in schools, raising hopes for the growth of this language all across Africa. A South African teacher here elaborates on the importance of the adoption of Swahili language in her country.
We do welcome the introduction of Swahili because we believe that it is going to promote unity and will promote intercontinental trade and exchanges within the continent.
More African countries are starting to teach Swahili language. What is motivating these countries to teach this East African language?
Its acceptability level is very, very high because, unlike many other languages, it's not ethnically bound in a strong way. So there is no strong ethnic identity associated with the Swahili language. And therefore, its acceptability is higher than, say, any of the other languages that we have, so that a Wolof speaker would be able to speak and learn Swahili without feeling that they are learning a very, very foreign language. In any case, it is situated on the continent. Its rhythm and spirit is the spirit and rhythm of the continent of Africa.
A glance at leading industrial countries across the world clearly shows that all school-going kids in these countries receive their elementary instruction in their first language. This includes countries in North America, Europe, and also Japan, China, South Korea, and Russia.
Now, a Nigerian teacher who has been teaching mathematics in a local language explains here on the advantages of using indigenous languages in a class.
One of the major popular research was done in the Yoruba land, where we had some students who were, for example, who were taught a subject using Yoruba language. So they had two groups of students. One group was taught a particular subject using Yoruba language, while another group was taught English language, and then taught the subject in English. When the result was looked at the end of the day, the highest success rate was recorded from the students who were taught using the Yoruba language. And that's because we can never rule out the power the mother tongue has with regard to learning.
While some indigenous languages in Africa are threatened with extinction, but as we have seen, the tide is turning as more and more young people are learning the languages. Yet to remain relevant, these indigenous languages need to embrace technology.
Now finally, my last question to you, Professor Kimani Njogu. Now what needs to be done to make indigenous African languages appear cool and attractive to the tech-savvy generation?
And African languages are adaptive to really the changing environment. They are never static. They are responsive to the changes that we experience every day. So, for example, with the entry of mobile phones, African languages are at play in that technology, and they are utilized pretty well in really articulating the technologies. The other area of work really is to link the techies with language workers. Those of us who work with language every day ought to be able to work closely with innovators, with technologists, to be able to come up with terms that best serve, you know, the needs of the techies.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Kimani Njogu, a member of the Kiswahili Cross-Border Language Commission at the African Academy of Languages. Now, unfortunately, our time is up for today. It's an interesting topic, and for sure, we shall revisit this subject in future and maybe even speak in a common African language. And on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. I'm sure you enjoyed the show, so let's know what you think by dropping us a line through our social media handle. And until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.